Welcome to New Books in Intellectual History. I'm your host, Carl Nellis, and today we're talking with Andrew Cole, professor of English and director of the Goss Seminars in Criticism at Princeton University. We're talking about Andrew's new book, The Birth of Theory, published in 2014 by the University of Chicago Press. Andrew, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much, Carl. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, it's a real pleasure to have you. You make some significant contributions with this book to theory and to an intellectual history of theory as it's developed really to the present day. And you do that by exploring the long and often neglected medieval period of development and dialectics, and particularly the way that Hegel drew on medieval theologians and philosophers and their work in developing his own sense of dialectics. Can you tell us a little bit about what brought you to this project and got you started?
Good. Well, thank you so much. And again, thank you for this opportunity to talk about my book with you. The book was really something I've been thinking about for a very long time. I would say that my work on the Middle Ages, and I'm a professor of medieval literature primarily, that my work on the Middle Ages and my education on the medieval period was coterminous with my study of philosophy, my discovery of Marx when I was an undergraduate, and then from Marx to Hegel, and a very difficult class on metaphysics at Loyola University in Chicago back in the late 80s. So my work as a medievalist has always been linked to my work as a theorist, thinking about questions of intellectual history, thinking about the philosophical, not only ideological or political, but the philosophical importance of studying medieval culture, studying the deep past. So my education and my writing all the way through to the PhD, where I worked at and graduated from Duke University, was involved in linking these two questions together. But I, at the time when I finished my PhD, I wasn't quite ready to offer something like The Birth of Theory. And I wrote The Birth of Theory there's some material in the book that goes back to 1995. So it's a book I've been thinking about for a very long time. And I can't imagine thinking about the Middle Ages without thinking about philosophy and intellectual history.
Yeah, on that note, let's dive in and talk about the book and where you start. Because at the outset, you set yourself some really interesting challenges with this book. You say you want to explain a long arc of intellectual history that puts Plotinus, Proclus, Pseudo-Dionysius, Eckhart, Hegel, and Heidegger all within the same long tradition of dialectical thinking.
Right.
You say you want to address what makes Hegel truly Hegelian.
Right.
You even set yourself what seems to me the challenging task of reconciling Deleuze with dialectics. And then to get that whole thing kicked off, you start with Nietzsche.
Right.
Can we talk a little bit about why Nietzsche to get us going?
Right. Thank you so much for that. What I was really wanting to do is to try to unthink Hegel. I think that it's now impossible to think about what Hegel has contributed to modern thought, what Hegel has contributed to philosophy, what the Hegelian difference is from his notorious, well-known predecessor, Kant. I mean, there are figures in between, right? But I'm very much interested in what makes Hegel different from anyone else writing at the time, including Schelling. To unthink what we know about Hegel, which includes unthinking the cliches that we are so familiar with about Hegel. And so the starting point there would have to be, I really do think, I mean, I can understand where a starting point would be Marx. Indeed, I could see where a starting point could be Schelling. I mean, these two notoriously got into it with one another in terms of how Hegelianism is caricaturized, right? How it's sort of generated into a cliche. But I wanted to start with Nietzsche because it seemed to me that Nietzsche is a signal moment, well, also in The Birth of Theory, also in a critique of philosophy as such, also in a critique of certain kinds of conceptuality that are inherited from Kant, therefore also a critique of the subject. Okay, so it seems that Nietzsche would be the person who would be most challenging to this account, that you can't get through an account of The Birth of Theory without getting through Nietzsche. Okay,
mm-hmm.
And this is where Deleuze hooks up with the question, because we know Deleuze's famous work, it's an early work, but Nietzsche and philosophy, I think, is a source of cliches about Hegelianism in modern thinking. And it's the beginning, including for Deleuze himself, which I think Deleuze is misleading himself. But it's that book, Nietzsche and Philosophy, is the beginning of this antagonism, this wide chasm between Deleuzeanism and Hegelianism. And so I thought if I could get that question addressed, which indeed the chapter is both somewhat about, it's largely about Nietzsche. We're talking about the first chapter called The Untimely Dialectic and the Birth of Theory. It's mostly about Nietzsche, but it's also framed with respect to Deleuze, right? And that anticipates my conversation in the final chapter called On Dialectical Interpretation, which returns to the question of Deleuze. So that's the first part of that answer, is to say dealing with the cliches, right? Because the cliches sort of screen some of the more obvious features of what Hegel's dialectic is. And this is the second difficulty, I believe, is getting someone to answer the question of what is Hegel's dialectic. I think it's a question that is simple to answer. I think it's a question that's been answered too complexly. The question is answered simply because the answer involves a very complex logical process that was invented, and this is where we bring forth then the figures that you had mentioned as well, Plotinus, Proclus, Pseudo-Dionysius, a whole range of thinkers, but that the logical form at the center of the dialectic is the logical form of identity and difference. Okay, so when we, on my account, when we talk about the dialectic, fundamentally, we are talking about the interplay, the relationship, the tensions between identity and difference. Now, in subsequent philosophical thinking, you have identitarian philosophy, identity philosophy, you have philosophies of difference, right? We can choose one side of this, well, let's call it a binary, I call it a dialectic, but we can choose one side of this binary and still not get very far from the other term. I think this is the case with Deleuze in a philosophy of difference or a philosophy of multiplicity. Now what we see is an emphasis on the negative, which I still consider in similar terms. And then, of course, the identitarian philosophies that Theodor Adorno critiques early in his, well, appropriately titled Negative Dialectics. Okay, so it is to remove the cliches, to look at the obviousness of the complexity of the dialectic itself. That is, what makes it so interesting, what makes it so dynamic, what makes it move, indeed, what makes it dialectical, are these two logical categories. So I detail a little bit of that in the preface. Then I want to go into, again, in chapter one, the Nietzschean reception of that. And what I want to say with Nietzsche and why I picked Nietzsche's Birth of Tragedy as a site thinking about the birth of theory is because Nietzsche does some really complex things there. He does not talk in terms of Hegelian cliches so much. The thing to really to notice is that when he cites the dialectic as this, let's call it a four-letter word, right? dialectic bad, dialectic Socrates. He never says dialectic Hegel. He had plenty of opportunity to do this. He never did that. What does that mean? Okay, and then secondarily, what does it mean that when Socrates came along, dialectic became all that's bad about not only ancient but modern thinking and philosophy. And his imaginative history that, you know, because it's very, very speculative. I mean, he wants to sort of ask for this, you know, return to tragedy in a new way that sometimes feels like, you know, if we could, you know, sometimes it feels like he's asking us all to be creative anachronists of some new kind, which makes a certain amount of sense because his time, his culture, including Nietzsche himself, was very much mesmerized. Well, really mesmerized by two things: classical antiquity on the one hand, and the medieval past on the other. You can think Novalis is an example of that, I would say, but. So what does he want to do? What will cure all that ails the present for Nietzsche? It is to go back to the time before Socrates, to the time when we didn't call this operation dialectic, but what we experience in our encounter with the tragic form is in this encounter between Apollo and Dionysius is this interplay of identity and difference. It's Nietzsche's way of saying we can no longer think of dialectic productively without the cliches, but here is something that is absolutely valuable to the genesis of tragedy in some sense of lyric culture, in some sense of literature. And if we could return to identity and difference, or at least perform a speculative history that will get us thinking within these categories again, then, of course, modernity would start to look different and would have a renewed understanding of its own past. So that's sort of Nietzsche as a model for a way of doing the history of dialectic. And the lesson there, I think, primarily is this. It's that we are accustomed to thinking about logic and logical terms as having always been there, as being sort of objective. The argument here and the practice that I seek to follow after Nietzsche, okay, is that logical forms have a history in themselves, that concepts have a history in them themselves. And that's Hegelian. I mean, I really can't think of another philosopher before Hegel who had argued this, that we can do philosophy, we can explore these conceptualities, we can do logic indeed, but then to sort of step back and to have this self-reflexive analysis of the moment, the time, the present that makes this kind of conceptuality possible, I can't think of anyone else who does that. And that, to me, is what distinguishes theory from philosophy, is on the one hand, trying to construct these conceptual architectures that pertain across time. This was the critique of Kant in the moments of cultural studies and cultural materialism in the 80s and 90s. It came with the critique of the Althusserian subject as well, but the idea that you would see in a lot of the critical writing in the late 80s and 90s was we must reject the transcendental subject because, right, all subjects are embodied, all subjects are in desire, the things that we think is just plain common sense. You talk about a person, in other words, not a term used a lot in theory, but you talk about a person in context, in history. And so, again, the basic lesson that I want to take from that is this pertains to the history of identity and difference, those two conceptual terms. And that's what Chapter 2, entitled The Medieval Dialectic, really gives us, is it's an attempt to write an origins story. I mean, these things are you have to be careful about writing origin stories, especially when you're doing something as preposterous as a history of the dialectic from Plato and Aristotle to Jameson and beyond. I'm fully aware of that. And in the book, I say this is a narrow investigation. I mean, I am, floating 6 feet off the ground here, even if that. It seems stratospheric because it's about the dialectic, logical forms, intellectual history, medieval stuff, which is weird to most people, and right, and not sort of familiar in terms of discussing modern theory. But it is to trace the emergence of the categories of identity and difference as they are properly and dialectically understood. And that's where Plotinus comes in as the foundational figure. Under the name of the discipline of dialectic, Plotinus reorganizes the Platonic primals, the five primes, in other words, being motion, rest, identity, and difference, and says what stands at the top of this, these five primaries is identity and difference, and that you put them there in the name of dialectic. And then from there, Plotinus practices a kind of dialectical thinking in logical terms, that really replicate some of the more lovely moments, or anticipate, I should say, some of the more lovely and ponderous moments that you find in Hegel. And it was in that connection then that I wanted to proceed to say, okay, you had, you know, you go from Plotinus to Hegel. How did we get there? And the way you get there, which is always usually the story, but you get there by going through the Middle Ages, by going through the reception history of Plotinus, by looking at what happens to the dialectic of identity and difference across the centuries, which then brings us up to Hegel. And the terrible mistake that I think that he was making at the time, I mean, it turned out to be a happy mistake or a happy fault, right? But it was to say, all the while he's doing teaching in secondary schools, doing gymnasium teaching, I think if he had to admit it, he would say, yes, he was eyeing the chair of philosophy at Berlin all along. Very ambitious individual, Hegel. That his way to make his mark in modern philosophy is to embrace the very thing that Kant said in his moment of, you know, in his Copernican revolution of philosophy, is the thing that we must reject, which is the dialectic. So it's entirely a stupid move, if you really want to think about it that way, that I'm going to do something new by doing something completely old, doing something that no Kantian in his or her right mind would adopt. And so that's how you get to Hegel. That's the question of the past and the present. That's the question of anachronism in theory. That's the question of historical unevenness. Where you go, you know, depending on where you are, you're at a different moment in time. And that's where Hegel's philosophy is perfect for this kind of thinking, which we would call dialectical thinking. So let me put a full stop there to see if there's something I can elaborate on.
Yeah, let's, before we go too far forward, I just want to mention that you've structured the book in three parts, two chapters each. The first you call theory, and the second history, and the third literature. But even in that first section, the second chapter really kind of jumps back. The second chapter is called The Medieval Dialectic, and you explore in more detail the way that the dialectic of identity and difference developed through Plotinus, through Proclus, through Nicholas of Cusa, and you're really careful to note that it's not like dialectics was monolithic in the Middle Ages. You even are really careful to note that identity and difference was just one of the many dialectics that were explored. Can you talk a little bit more about those medieval dialecticians before we really jump forward into that second section of the book, history?
Oh, yes, yes, I would love to. Just a little, so a footnote to the opening out of the question. I mean, where are Proclus and Nicholas of Cusa, and even you, and even Heidegger, who some would say, does he really belong in this narrative? But all three, and the answer to that is yes, because all three are part of a tradition commentating on the Parmenides. So the what's new here is a different way, a new way of commenting on this widely commented upon text, the Parmenides. And there are moments where I show Hegel is very aware that the kind of dialectic of identity and difference that, you know, we're discussing here is not available in Plato, is not available in Aristotle. So what I'm interested in there is looking at the various ways in which these medieval thinkers are aware of that. They are very much following Plotinus, even Heidegger, in commenting on the Parmenides in this fashion. This is absolutely right, though, what you point out. There are different kinds of dialectic in the Middle Ages. I think the one that concerns me the most, and the one that I think tends to take over early modern philosophy, there are some successions, yes, I have to say it that way, in Giordano Bruno, for instance, where you can see more of a kind of Plotinian dialectic at work there. But a major different kind of dialectic that is not the one that I'm discussing here, it has to be, I think, the skeptical dialectic, the dialectic of Sextus Empiricus. That dialectic is the one, well, which will make you a very capable debater, in the sense that here is a dialectic without the kind of without that. Let's just use this term. I will resort to this cliche. Without that moment of synthesis, without that moment of bringing together the opposition, even just in close proximity enough to generate some kind of identity from the difference in and of itself. And so what I mean here is in Sexus Empiricus, there are versions of this in Aristotle. And really, you know, if you want to take a broader look of it, it is the difference between an Aristotelian dialectic on the one hand and a Plotinian dialectic on the other. Plotinus was very much writing against Aristotle and thought that what Aristotle provided was too rule-bound, Plotinus says. So in Sextus Empiricus, you have a dialectic that is the thinking of both sides of the opposition to the farthest point possible and keep on thinking. So these two things never really come together in that respect, and provides an interesting contrast, I think, to the dialectic in Plotinus and the dialectic in Hegel. But the thing that I want to say on that is that Hegel is also aware of the different kinds of dialectic in the Middle Ages. I mean, he points this out in his lectures on the history of philosophy. The really, really interesting thing, and in fact, I got in an argument with this about Slavoj Žižek, because when we were discussing, you know, preposterously, the origins of the dialectic, he pointed out, but yes, in Hegel's lectures on the history of philosophy, he says that the dialectic in the Middle Ages is to be avoided, is a terrible thing. In fact, Hegel, yes, he says this, but what Hegel is pointing out is the fact that a kind of dialectic is the sort that should be avoided, right? And it's to understand dialectic, you know, with an S, dialectics that are plural, and it's to be reminded, as you're reminding us, that you have to understand that there are multiple versions of the dialectic available in the Middle Ages. So when Hegel picks out one and condemns it, it doesn't mean he's condemning all forms of medieval dialectic. He's smarter than that. That's, you know, the kind of nuance that you can bring to the text, to the Hegelian texts, when thinking about the dialectic as having multiple forms in the Middle Ages. The argument is that Hegel picks out a particular form against the other kinds of forms.
Yeah, yes, yes. And in particular, when you're discussing Pseudo-Dionysius, you get into what you call medieval dialectical phenomenology, and you explore his phrase that he's attempting to get beyond appearances. And this really looks ahead to what you're doing with literature. So before we leave Pseudo-Dionysius behind, can you talk a little bit about getting beyond appearances and the image and how that becomes really one of the major things that you're working with going forward?
Yeah, that's very interesting. And that's, you know, I mean, one really has to traverse the middle section to get there, because what I'm trying to argue is that in Hegel, you find the foundations for a kind of ideology critique. And what you need for that, I think, is on the one hand, theory and history, or theory and praxis, in other words. So you have to course through that second part. But I can say about part three that this thing called medieval dialectical phenomenology, what I'm trying to show there, and that's the space within, that's the register within which I talk about Hegel and Deleuze, or Deleuze and dialectics, let's say. But it is, let's say broadly speaking, that medieval dialectical phenomenology comes from what we can provisionally call mysticism. I know that's a kind of vexed term, and it doesn't really comprehend all that's available within whatever is designated by it. But what you have is not only in Plotinus this notion of identity and difference are dialectical, but that in dialectics is observation of a very intense kind. In other words, is the writing of a phenomenology. Is, in other words, what, you know, Barthes calls, and this is way, way after the fact, a history of looking, right? That there is this thing that we can think of called intersubjectivity. There are these processes that we can call recognition. These moments that we kind of sound like the stuff of the phenomenology of spirit, right? Most notoriously, again, part two creeping in here in this answer about part three, but most visible in the Lord Bondsman dialectic or the master-slave dialectic, that kind of intersubjectivity, that recognition of the other. This kind of intersubjectivity, this positing of an other, this recognition of an other, this kind of dialectical intersubjectivity, in other words, is staged in Plotinus in his encounter with the one, in his encounter with something that can be posited as an absolute other, in his exposition of how identity breaks apart into difference through its own self-reflection, right? Through an intense kind of in itself and for itself that for which the center can no longer hold, which becomes so intense that it breaks out into difference. And you know, in the Plotinian language, what that is the generation of out of the one, out of identity into difference. In other words, the one being, you know, the all, in other words, which is what Plotinus calls it, giving us difference, giving us the intellectual principle, giving us what we would recognize as the structures and movements necessary for cognition, difference, memory, narrative, language, and being. Okay. And so medieval dialectical phenomenology is that. And over the centuries, it becomes not, you know, a more, you know, abstract and mystified kind of Neoplatonism, certainly not by the time of Deleuze, but it becomes a style, right? So the question of medieval dialectical phenomenology ultimately becomes a question of writing, of what makes, just, you know, putting it in this term, in this way, what makes the phenomenology of spirit so dang different from the critique of pure reason, right? And it is one of the things is that it puts the viewing subject in the narrative itself about concepts. In a way, this is something that Kant hates and this is something that he avoids. Yeah, you know, and when you get to Deleuze, it becomes a style. It becomes, you can even see this in Nietzsche and philosophy, though I think it's really on display in his work with Guattari, A Thousand Plateaus. But where there is a narrative about concepts as if you're reading a novel, as if, you know, we're sort of sitting, watching, you know, how to use some of the language of Nietzschean philosophy, how affirmation and multiplicity are generated in their encounter with identity. That point of view on concepts that is then recorded as if it were a story about the life of concepts interacting with another, which is no wonder Hegel is read as a kind of literature. You know, this is the thing Richard Rorty hates about Hegel, that it seems, right, novelistic, literature sucks, it's different, it's fuzzy thinking, it's not philosophy. But I think literature is quite all right, and I think it survives these critiques, as does Hegel. So that, I hope that answers that bit about medieval dialectical phenomenology. I know it's ranging, but it has to.
Okay, so that brings us into the second part of the book. And you begin this history section with a note that that Marx critiques Hegel for not relating his philosophy to his material context. Can you talk about what makes Hegel a proto-Marxist and why Marx disavows him?
Yes. Can I read out that quotation? That would be because it's Marx says, and you know, and this is with Engels. I mean, this is the German ideology. It's often forgotten Engels' hand with this work, but let's just say that it's Marx. But it's just the epigraph that you're referring to reads as follows. It has not occurred to any one of these philosophers to inquire into the connection of German philosophy with German reality, the relation of their criticism to their own material surroundings, end quote. Now, first of all, that is exactly what dialectics is. And in my mind, that move that I discussed earlier, that is the kind of reflexive view on the kinds of conceptuality that you're generating, how history makes that possible, I claim is a Hegelian move, okay? But the claim is borne out in the analysis of the Lord Bondsman dialectic. And this is where I want to ask my friends in theory and philosophy, are you reading Hegel? I mean, there's been lots of discussion about this particular chapter. And I think that's because everyone sort of knows a little bit of something about the quote-unquote master-slave dialectic or Lord Bondsman dialectic. But in the German, and with the cross-referencing to basically everything else that Hegel wrote about the Lord Bondsman dialectic, it's absolutely clear that this is an effort of Hegel to relate his philosophy, to relate his conceptuality to the contemporary German present, which was decidedly and largely feudal, right? We want to think of Hegel as, you know, one of the first modern philosophers. And so we think of him as sort of living in modernity. And then, of course, we have, you know, Napoleon coming in heroically on his muscular white horse, you know, which Hegel, you know, may have seen or may not have seen as he was finishing up the Phenomenology of Spirit, which then in turn gives a kind of modern character to the Phenomenology of Spirit. But it's all of this, I think, is forgetting the basic lessons of Marxism, which is the basic lesson of dialectics, but indeed the basic lessons of Marxism, which is the history of modes of production. You can read the most untheoretical account of the German states at the time, they will all tell you that Germany is still in the Middle Ages, is still a society whose mode of production is what falls under the name of feudalism. Now, Hegel refers to these modes of production, I argue, in the Lord Bondsman dialectic, first by naming, you know, naming the two characters, you know, Herr and Knecht, not master and slave. I'm sympathetic to that naming, and I'm very sympathetic to the kind of reading that naming can generate. But I first want to pause over Hegel and his moment and try to understand what it is he's doing in that moment. And then that naming, and then in the narrative itself, which is a narrative about labor, about working the land, it's a narrative about expropriation in decidedly feudal terms, is Hegel's way of telling us that he has, quoting Marx again, that it has occurred to him to inquire into the connection of German philosophy with German reality. Full stop. That's Hegel. There is your Hegel. Thinking in a way that I say in the introduction or in the preface to the Burgerfuhr, that is presciently Marxist. And that is what makes Hegel Hegelian, is the dialectic, is the inquiry into the material surroundings. And indeed, it is what makes Marx Marx. This is where he starts. And it seems to me one of the things I try to do at the end of chapter 3 on the Lord Bondsman dialectic is to say that he never gets very far away from thinking about the Lord Bondsman dialectic in those terms. And so what I want to say, and I say this elsewhere, and maybe we'll get to talk about that at the conclusion, that if that form of thinking is good enough for Marx, then it's good enough for me, right?
Yeah. Before we leave that behind, can you talk a little bit more about the struggle between possession versus ownership of land in what would have been Hegel's understanding of feudalism?
Right. So Hegel is a student of the Middle Ages because one of the claims I want to say is that he lives in it. He understands the dynamics and contradictions of ownership and possession in his time. These are the terms that contemporary historians like Mark Bloch or like J.A.F. Thompson, like J.J. Sheehan, point out themselves without having really, you know, any stake in the question of Hegel. In feudalism, you have this really interesting structure. I think retrospectively, Marxists would say that what distinguishes feudalism from capitalism is the separation of the political instance from the economic instance. What that simply means is the fact that in feudalism, there is no reason why a peasant producer needs to give up his or her yield to the person above him or her. And that the only way that that transaction transpires is through political force. You have to give this to me. Okay. That's where the instance where that's an example of where the political and the economic are working hand in hand. Now, why you need a political force to come in and to, you know, extract peasant surplus is because it's never really clear. There's so many instances of this, but it's never really clear what the answer to the question is, whose land is this?
Right.
There are so many ways of answering that question. One answer is an answer that is that attends to the problem of effective possession. So let's introduce that as a third term, possession, and you know, or a middle term, effective possession, which is to say that my family has been on this land for centuries. This is our land, right? This is our land. Now, who owns the land beats me. I think the monastery up the hill may own the land, but they're known for faking deeds. So, you know, and which is notorious in the history of possession and title, that, you know, the literate apparatus kind of generates ex nihilo legal documents that claim ownership. And you can run up the scale of sub-infeudination to get various answers to this question of who owns the land. And so really what that, you know, focus our attention on is the fact that effective possession is labor, is work, is plowing, is Hegel thinks of plowing as negation, but we know from draft material related to the phenomenology of spirit that what he's talking about is plowing. In other words, working, shaping the land. And so it is through work that not only do we have effective possession or possession, but it is through work that we gain self-possession as well. It is through work that we realize self-consciousness, okay? And this is what opens up onto the earlier Marx, right? Like the idea that labor is what, you know, makes the human and fundamentally and distinguishes the human. So we have those ideas coming out of Hegel there, which are ideas that, again, you can find in the most innocent sort of historiography writing about the history of the Middle Ages without any stake in Hegel, which I think kind of confirms the thesis and then makes, you know, Hegel's narrative all the more compelling for looking at the problem of labor at the transition between feudalism and capitalism. But maybe I should pause here to see if I can elaborate in any way.
Well, actually, at this point, I'd love to jump ahead into the next chapter where you say that what the Middle Ages was to Hegel, modernity is to Marx.
Right, right, right.
And you kind of explore that idea with the fetish and how they both use that. Can you pick up on that point and explore that a little bit for listeners?
Oh, yeah, please. Any reader of Marx's Capital will note that it starts out in an odd place, very different from how some of the draft material starts out related to Capital, like the Gundrisse. But it's to say that Marx starts out his analysis of Capital by basically talking about, among other things, and this is in part four of the first section, but talking about fetishism, talking about commodity fetishism. And it seems that it's entirely necessary to Marx to understand commodity fetishism, or, you know, the compulsion for us to relate to ourselves and to each other through commodities, through the things that we acquire, through the things that, again, we possess or have, that he wants to explain this obsession through the language of the Eucharist, plain and simple. There's one point, it's in a separate writing, but where Hegel talks about fetishism as a kind of transubstantiation, that he thinks of where he talks about in that fourth section of Capital, the miraculous and wondrous transformation of an ordinary thing that we use into this miraculous transformed thing that we exchange and that we name as exchange value. So as I was thinking about that, and after my truly decades of reading Hegel, I thought, you know, this sounds familiar to me. So I went back to read some of Hegel's writings on religion and some of his early theological writings as well. And I thought, ah, this is it. This is not an accident that he wants to talk about the commodity as the Eucharist. It's because Hegel, to flip the terms, this is very dialectical, but because Hegel talks about the Eucharist as a commodity, as a thing that over the history of religion up into the present, and especially up through the Middle Ages, returning to that question again, where the commodity is something that is bought, where the commodity is something, is a thing through which people relate, is a commodity that replaces the relationship between people with a relationship between things. And I think that is where Marx gets his fetishism. I know that there is some really important foundational work I, too, have read and been deeply influenced by, you know, William Pietz's work on, you know, the sources, in other words, of thinking about fetishism that Marx may have used. I think it's quite obvious that the source is Hegel in thinking about the commodity as fundamentally a Eucharist, again, because Hegel will, you know, in the long run, think about the Eucharist as fundamentally a commodity.
Right. Yeah, you're careful to note in the book that Marx's use of transubstantiation is deliberate, and it, you know, is taken from, as you say, Hegel's work on religion. And so when Marx is talking about the commodity in those terms, he's doing it very knowingly, and he's doing it in the mode that Hegel used that term, transubstantiation.
I think so, because there's an entire specular language that is there. There's a language that about commodities being sacralized. There's these intersubjective moments between Peter and Paul, and then really the signal here is that, you know, Marx says that, you know, to understand you know, the problem of fetishism is to enter into the misty realm of religion. I mean, that's him saying, okay, now please bring out and turn to, you know, chapter, you know, X of Hegel's theological writings. I mean, to say that you need the language of religion to talk about the miracle of the commodity is just one of those attributes of Marx's style and vocabulary in that section, which points us to that. And right, and transubstantiation as a complex kind of thinking. I mean, indeed, it's not just a question of style and vocabulary, but what is it that transubstantiation impels us to think, in other words? I mean, how can you think of how can you violate the principle of non-contradiction, as from Aristotle, affirmed by Kant, of course, and as disrupted by Hegel? But how is it that you can think that two different things are in fact the same thing, that you can look at a Eucharistic wafer and say, here is the bloody sacrificial body of Jesus Christ? How do you do that? What is required? What are you thinking? And it's that thinking that Marx maps onto the thinking about, okay, here's a thing that I think of as a use value. Here's a thing that makes me feel special and different from everyone else. And yet here's a thing that is an exchange value that everyone else is also using to think differently about himself or herself. To have these two thoughts at the same time about a single thing, these two contradictory thoughts about a single thing at the same time, is, you know, what transubstantiation as a term provides us. And I think that's what Marx really wants to focus on in using that term.
On that, kind of on that note, thinking about using particular terms and particular forms, let's jump to the final part of the book, part three, where you talk about literature and ideology, and you come back to that idea of what representations are. And let's, if you would, jump into the way that you explore the medieval genres and how they're used as critiques of political economy, and what some of that looks like, in particular Furstenspiegel, and how you use that going forward in wrapping up the book and coming to Deleuze and to theory proper, what we would consider, what we think of as critical theory today.
Right, right. Let me come on in. My cat is just screaming at the door, so if I let him, he'll calm down. Hello. So what I want to do there is just, and this is something I'm going to return to in the follow-up to The Birth of Theory, but is to say, what is the status of literature in all of this? If we're doing theory, if we're doing history, you know, if we're talking about style, if we're talking about vocabulary, can we talk about literature? Can we talk about genre? Now, the answer to that, as it's, you know, in the Marxist tradition, is absolutely yes. I would really, you know, I mean, part of what I want to say is that the a particular kind of historicism, what we name as historicism, beating literature in context, began in Hegelianism. That's part of the account that I offer in the final chapter, chapter 6, and looking at 19th century forms of Hegelianism in England. Okay. Mm-hmm. But that's to open up to say, what is it about literature that is so important? Why do we care? What is it about literary thinking that enables us to do these two other things, enables us to think theoretically, enables us to think historically, not just write theory in this way that Hayden White, you know, talks about in, you know, the genres of history and so on and so forth, but to how is thinking historically and thinking theoretically facilitated by literature. And so, you know, this is touching on a rich tradition of Marxist historicism that I think reaches its apex in the work of my teacher, Frederick Jameson. I'm talking here about the political unconscious. And that's to say then that, right, literature is doing conceptual work, just to get to the point. We don't think of literature as science. Some people like to think of literature as philosophy. We have journals dealing specifically with that question. But what sort of conceptual space is literature? And I want to close on literature in the book because that's fundamentally dialectics in and of itself. It's been identified by the dialectical tradition that literature is a kind of conceptual thinking, but it is not. It's a different kind of conceptual thinking. It is not the same as a concept. And so what I was interested in doing in chapter 5 and 6 is first showing how literary thinking is crucial to how Hegel writes about dialectical thinking, that in the Phenomenology of Spirit, we not only deal with, you know, the genre of tragedy, and that's really what everyone wants to talk about, right? And, you know, and the tragic form as a literary form, but to remind ourselves that all through the Phenomenology of Spirit, we have these genres, and they look to me to be largely medieval genres. We have, I didn't discuss this in The Birth of Theory, but we have romance in that section on frenzy and self-conceit. And we have Fürstenspiegel, or Mirror for Princes writing, which part of my argument there is to say that Hegel adopts a genre to offer a critique of Adam Smith. Hegel never went to England. What's at stake in a critique of Adam Smith, right? Hegel never went to England to witness firsthand English modernity. It wasn't Hegel, who was in the British Library, like a Karl Marx, you know, writing the critique of Capital. So Hegel never saw this stuff firsthand. His context was one that was largely agrarian and feudal. Hence, you know, the often, you know, observed idea that, in other words, that Germany is belated, that it's behind and historically. Okay. Hegel uses genre through which to critique the wealth of nations, to critique modern political economy. In other words, there is Hegel's attempt to think about the critique of capitalism through Adam Smith, right? And so then we get a sense of genre as something that, or let's just say broadly, a sense of literature as indicative of something, that it's through literature that you can think about the history of capitalism. It is through literature through which is registered the contradictions that get us from feudalism to capitalism. And this is entirely what you see in a tradition of Marxist writing from Lukács to Macheret to Jameson and to many, many points in between. Okay. And so I wanted to end the book, that's chapter 5. I wanted to end the book in saying, What is it about literature? Let's look at this question of again. Okay, part of what I do in that final chapter on dialectical interpretation is to embroider the critical history as we know it. To say that the dialectical interpretation of literature precedes, Marx, who of course was a great reader of literature, loved literature, reader of Shakespeare. Reading literature to his daughter at night, all the rest, that the dialectical, but after Marx, indeed, right, the point being, after Marx, indeed, you don't really see, Marx didn't write an aesthetics, right? I mean, he wrote a treatise on calculus, for God's sake, but he did not write an aesthetics. We really, really miss that, and it really takes, you really only see that much, much later, I think, in its proper form, in Lukács. But between Marx and Lukács is the dialectical criticism that goes on in England that looks exactly at these questions that I'm identifying here. The other thing I do in chapter six is to say, let's focus again on the question of literature and philosophy as the question of the concept and the figure. It's to say that philosophy never really gets away from figural thinking, never gets away from literature. That conceptuality is always undone through the figuration, through the style, through the exemplarity, through the example necessary to express itself. That is the lesson of the phenomenology of spirit. That is the lesson of Hegelianism. That is the lesson of dialectics. And that is why you end a book on the birth of theory and literature, and that is why you read literature.
Yeah, thank you so much. That does really bring us neatly to the end of the book, though there's so much richness of detail and research and thinking that's there that we haven't had time to explore. Before we wrap up, I wonder if you'd talk a little bit about the first response to the book. It's been out for long enough that there's been some writing about it. In the past year, a couple of pieces published in PMLA about the book. Can you talk a little bit about what the first response to the book has been?
Okay. Yes, no, thank you very much. I mean, we'll see, what happens over the next 2 years, I guess. Most of the responses have been extremely positive and generous. It's obviously produced some debate, some with some of my friends. I love this because it people are talking about dialectics in this very kind of fundamental Hegelian Marxian way that I think a lot of contemporary criticism has gotten away from. So even if I disagree with a particular reception of the book, you're talking about Hegel. Looking again at the phenomenology of spirit, you're having to ask these questions. The thing, for instance, I love, Warren Montauk in the PMLA panel wrote a very generous, he was critical. But to me, I loved it because the thing that I want to say is that, so Warren Montauk is very known, is probably the most important Althusserian scholar out there. And I've been reading him for years, so I was delighted to see his analysis. And I didn't expect ahead of time for someone who studies Althusser to really kind of be in the mood to write about a book on Hegel. But he came in there with, I think, immense critical generosity to the extent of saying, okay, I'm going to look at this history of philosophy again from the perspective of Hegel and dialectics. And that's what I want people to do. I mean, if you're doing that, then we have something to talk about. And so that would be my first response, even to, readers who might be skeptical about some of the claims. I mean, there are a lot of reviews that are extremely generous and aren't skeptical at all. But even the ones, again, that are negative, we'll say, are thinking about Hegel, clarifying their own ideas about Hegel, and bringing Hegel back into the conversation, which I think is a positive thing. So that would be my first response there. And, in the section on PMLA that we read, it seemed to play out. I mean, I think apart from the review by C.D. Blanton, an amazing scholar, at Berkeley, who has just published a book called Epic Negation, which I think is the most important book on dialectics to be published yet in modernism, if not in literature, recently. I would certainly check that one out too. Extraordinary scholar. Also an example of saying, hey, I'm going to look at this history of the dialectic again, and wanted to sort of take me to task for not clarifying what I meant about analogy. And, you know, and yes, that means that, you know, that footnote or two there wasn't sufficient. I confess, I didn't look up. It's always the case. You think you can get away with it by writing a footnote, but no. And largely, I would say, just my general response to the other contributions, that it seemed to me that when we're getting into really the weeds of the thing, most people like to focus on one chapter or another. Why I admire Blanton's response, why I admire Warren Montag's response, why I admire Jordana Rosenberg's response is they try to deal with the whole book. The other authors, I think, want to, you know, hone in on some of the details of the particular chapters without looking at what the rest of the book is trying to argue. I get that as well, because it's just the case that, you know, how much of this can one handle? I mean, and how much of a book, you know, every book is sort of known by a particular chapter or two. So, you know, it makes perfect sense that if you're going to spend time with Hegel, why don't we just talk about the master-slave dialectic? Because that's where most people spend their time if they're not, you know, doing something, you know, doing something else, like going for a walk in the woods or whatnot. So, yeah, that's my general response to that. But I must say that I was very engaged by that opportunity, and it allowed me to write a response called The Function of Theory at the Present Time, which was an opportunity to state in fewer than 10,000 words what the hell I'm doing and what the theory is about. So that was extraordinary. And to do it into PMLA, which has a, you know, an enormous readership, I mean, yeah, let's do this. So I have to say I was very pleased by the reception of the book in that form.
Thanks so much. We're wrapping up at this point, but before we go, could you tell us a little bit more about what you're working on now?
Yes. So I'm finishing a book. So the Birth of Theory is the first installment of a 3-volume work. And I'm finishing the second installment. You know, you can think of it as the sequel to The Birth of Theory. It's called Foundations of the Dialectic. So it's another one of those stories about what's essential about the dialectic, but also another origins story, let's say. This time I'm focusing in on the encounter or the relationship between Kant and Hegel. So the book really starts in Kant. I think that one thing, has been observed to me in conference panels that, you know, I wish, you know, Andrew talked more about Kant. I mean, I do have a section on Kant, right, in the Antinomies. And, you know, I think that's right. And so I begin in Kant and then carry the book forward. Now, the structure of the book is organized around key terms in the dialectic. So I focus on terms that are not the expected ones. So I'm not going to be talking about thesis, antithesis, and synthesis, though I do, you know, say why we shouldn't just talk about that. But I also don't really want to dwell overlong on Aufhebung or on contradiction or any of the other terms that are familiar to, you know, in the dialectical discourse. What I focus on and what I devote a chapter to each is on one, the first chapter being on the example by Spiele, the example, in other words, in Kant. That is, Kant hates examples. Hegel loves examples. How do you get from Kant to Hegel? Right there at that moment is foundational to the conception of dialectics. It's why Hegel turned to dialectics. And then in the following chapter, we deal with the image or the Bild, and looking at the sort of specular forms that Hegel adopts early in the Phenomenology of Spirit and throughout the whole thing. Then the third chapter is on the element. Element is a word that runs throughout all kinds of dialectical writing, and it's never been noticed. It's never been picked out as one of the key terms here. And so that is a term that links Hegel to Marx, that draws in the question of realism, literary and philosophical. And then finally, I have a chapter on substance, from Aristotle to Zizek, really. And again, it's one of those long, you know, has the feel of, say, chapter 2 or chapter 6 of The Birth of Theory, a kind of an exposition from antiquity to the Middle Ages to modernity about what the philosophical term substance means, because I think there is a lot of confusion about that. So, for example, when one says, talks about, you know, social substance, for instance, what exactly is that? And now that we're, a lot of people are interested in talking about matter and materiality, substance is often thrown into that. And it's just generating a lot of confusion. And I think that's where dialectics can clarify not only what substance is and how we should think about it after Kant, but it's also then an opportunity for me to do something that I've always done in my teaching but haven't yet done in print, which is to talk about Hegel and Spinoza on the question of substance. So you're going to get your Hegel and Spinoza in that final chapter. If you survive the first three, you get that.
Andrew, thanks so much. It's been a pleasure talking. It's a pleasure reading the book, The Birth of Theory, out from the University of Chicago Press. So go out and get your copy. Andrew, thanks so much for joining us on the show.
Carl, it was great to have this conversation with you. I'm very grateful for the opportunity as well.